I'm your co-host, Nicole Delson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with debut novelist Lauren Acampara. But first up, author Mary Beth Hughes. Mary Beth is the author of the best-selling novel Wavemaker 2, a New York Times notable book, and the acclaimed collection Double Happiness, which earned a Pushcart Prize. Her stories have been published in the Paris Review, Plowshares, Georgia Review, and A Public Space. She lives in Brooklyn and Rhinebeck, New York. Her new book is called The Loved Ones, published by Grove Atlantic. And I'd like to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Mary Beth.
Hi, Nicole. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, I'm so glad you could join us. Now, to get started, I'd like to have you introduce your book for us. Could you tell us what The Loved Ones is about?
Sure, I'd love to. So The Loved Ones is a novel, and it's set in 1969, 1970, into early 1971. And it's set on the New Jersey shore, also in New York City and in London. And the story revolves around a very small family, the Devlins. But I actually think the book concentrates on the marriage. So it's kind of a story of a marriage between Jean and Nick Devlin. When the novel opens, they've been married for about 15 years, and they've already had some pretty serious challenges. Nick got involved in a kind of a very shady financial deal as a young man, thanks to his older brother, Lionel. And he's still sort of unwinding the repercussions from that, sort of legally. But more recently, Nick and Jean Devlin have lost their son about 2 years before the novel opens, and they're very much trying to find their way with that. And I think especially to one another. They have a young daughter who is 13 years old, and her name is Lily, and she's kind of orbits around them, and she's getting into her own kind of trouble. What sort of sets the novel in motion is that Nick has been offered a pretty glamorous job in London with an American cosmetic company that's expanding there, and he really wants to take the job. He thinks that not only is it a great opportunity, but it will help them, help especially he and Jean kind of find their balance once again. So he's very excited to move, but Jean is not. She grew up in this place on the Jersey Shore, which is very beautiful, and her family is still there, and she's very attached to it and very identified with especially her home, and which she's made very beautiful. So off they go, and the sort of looming disaster for them in this is that Nick's older brother, Lionel, the sort of the wheeler dealer in his life, sees Nick's new job not as kind of a great opportunity for this family, but actually for a great opportunity for an embezzlement scheme. So his presence and sort of the pressure, he very gradually sort of builds toward making this happen. Kind of sets the, I think, the pulse for the novel. So that's what it's about.
Okay. And when you began describing it, you said that it was the story of a marriage. And so I'm curious, because you came out of a story collection before publishing this novel. And how did this novel begin for you? Did you focus on the marriage at first, or what was your point of entry into the story?
Well, it was a couple of things I think were important to me in sort of beginning this novel. One of the is sort of the relationship between Jean, the wife of in the marriage, and her brother-in-law Lionel, this sort of very seductive, very complex figure. I think Jean, I think in sort of in the way that sometimes happens in families, sort of feels like she understands him and knows him, and in that way can sort of offset any difficulties he might present, but I don't think that's true, and that sort of gets challenged as the novel progresses. The other thing that I think was really kind of important to me and probably difficult for me in this novel was that in Wavemaker 2, my first novel, there was sort of a thread of a child who is imperiled. He has a very serious illness But his the in Waymaker 2, he does pretty well, and the book closes with, you know, sort of a sense of hope about him. So this novel, though it's a very different family and kind of a very, very different circumstances, picks up that sort of inner thread and asks, you know, sort of what happens when that sort of hope has been shattered, and, you know, when the child has been lost. And it's a much, I think, tougher story, really, to tell. So it was hard for me.
I'm talking to Mary Beth Hughes. Her new novel is The Loved Ones. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Mary Beth, I'd say that one of your strengths as a storyteller is in sensory details in your descriptions, especially smell. And I think that's one that's often overlooked. So to give you just a sense of what I'm referring to, a brief quote, Sheldon's suit trousers draped over the lampshade made a blocky, dramatic shadow across Sheldon's downcast face. Nick plucked up his drink and took a warm sip. Formaldehyde and toasting damp wool made a foul aroma. And so... could you talk about picking out these smells and all of these specific details to bring a scene to life?
I could definitely try, for sure. I think that sort of sensory details, for me anyway, kind of arise out of the characters, sort of what's going on for them. I really try to place myself very much in their minds, their spirits, sort of their bodies in the moment that things are happening. So I think the scene that you've read, Nick is in, you know, he's in a hotel room. There's a lot kind of happening. It's a pretty wild party. And sort of, I was sort of thinking what all would be sort of coming to him in that moment. He also has some business things actually riding on this very curious scene. So all the various things he's trying to juggle, and the man whose trousers are kind of giving off that very unfortunate aroma is someone he's kind of interested in as a colleague. So part of that particular smell is sort of understanding that this colleague is out of his depth a little bit, you know, when things are not going well. So I think, you know, smell can often be, you know, a good messenger for sort of the emotional temperature of a scene, you know, in a way that if things smell good, that's usually things are going well for the character in that moment often.
And I thought it played off the theme of memory too, because smell is so tightly wound to our memories.
Yes. Yeah. It's true. And, you know, of course, if he's smelling formaldehyde, there's that whole sort of undercurrent, you know, of what he's often struggling not to remember, actually, in Nick's case. So I think that's a really nice connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is that level of detail of trying to put yourself in the character's noses or, you know, whatever, is that something you attend to in the first draft, or do you leave that for subsequent drafts, or where does that come out for you?
Yeah, I think that that comes up right away, you know, sort of those sort of details. There's a scene sort of with the daughter Lily when she's meeting this boy by chance who she has an enormous crush on, and they're actually, it's happening in the middle of winter, but there's an ashtray that looks like a watermelon that sort of becomes sort of interesting to them, and it was there, you know, sort of from the very beginning, and it sort of acts, I think, as kind of a memory of sort of those sort of romantic summers that Lily is just beginning to have, and I don't know. So they seem to come right away, actually.
Mm-hmm. Now would be a good time for you to read to us from your book. Would you read to us from The Loved Ones?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Nicole. So I'm going to read right from the beginning, and I'll just go ahead and start. So from The Loved Ones, winter 1969. Only a flurry. A thin blanket of white, something to take the gray mounds of snow and make them new. It began at dawn and fell over the blighted grass and the frozen river, turning everything beautiful for a moment. Jean Devlin started her car, the Valiant wagon she used for errands. Soon the car was warm enough to drive, and Jean made the reverse up the steep curve, then backed into the roadside pull-off where most delivery drivers chickened out and parked. They'd rather hand-carry a refrigerator than make the plunge, but Jean could do it blindfolded. Actually, everyone gave up and parked here, it was true. Over the years, she'd widened the pull-off to something almost stately, with a stone wall framing a pretty stone stair that zigzagged under the spruce trees. She'd made those steps walkable. No matron climbing down for a house tour would tumble off her slingbacks and sue. Every summer for the last five, Jean's quiet little cape had made the designer showcase. A star, the best of the best, her father crowed. Jean idled on the ridgetop and watched the snow sift down through the branches and thought of him, her father studying her face, so like his own, assessing. You never have to be anyone else, he liked to say. Just tell them who you are. I'm Clyde Bull's daughter, she'd shout when tiny, and he'd find her a silver dollar. Then she was 19 years old, and he was giving her a wedding gift. He'd just won Gooseneck Cove, and on this day, they were taking a closer look. Her father, stiff-legged, even then, shoved aside the goldenrod grown thick in the trace of a gravel drive. She lifted her skirt high so she wouldn't spoil her sundress. They sidestepped down and stood in an open patch of long, wet grass. Blue spruce and birches made a wide open circle, like the property was an amphitheater set to watch the drama of the river. The house was rotted up to the caved-in roof. Crows screeched from the trees at their intrusion, and a water rat slid out through a broken window into a break in the cattails. Jean screamed, and her father pulled her close to his chest. Don't be daft, Jeanie. It's a mouse. A stench like something dead and decaying canceled the wet, soft, piney air, but she could still feel it on her skin, and she turned to see what the blue needles did, shivering, reflected in the water. What she'd make of all this. What a talent she had. Everyone said so. Then they climbed back up the ridge, Jean stepping like a deer on the lookout for garter snakes.
Thank you.
So, okay. You're welcome.
That was author Mary Beth Hughes reading from her new book, The Loved Ones. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Mary Beth, what you just read to us there is the beginning. When you were writing, did the beginning, was it always clear to you, or did you have to figure out where your story began?
That beginning with Jean sort of in her car looking at the snow is the original beginning. She's actually about to run an errand with her dog, who she has trouble with. So there was a little bit of that, a little more of the dog in that first scene, but I've moved the dog just one step in. So the very next thing that happens is the dog appears. So I think that's the only thing that changed in that very beginning.
Wow. Did you have an outline before that, or are you a pantser?
A pantser? I've never heard that phrase. It's very funny. That means someone who prowls through their book to try to find it.
Or writes from the seat of their pants. Or
from the seat of their... Oh, a pantser. I thought you said panther, like a big cat. That's funny. Yes, I'm a pantser, yes, very much going by the seat of my pants. And then sort of many, many revisions. That seems to be my process.
So as an author, you've written two novels now and many successful short stories. Is there a form that you prefer? Or
I think that short stories, I love short stories. I like that they sort of can complete themselves fairly quickly. Like the whole shape is there, and that's so satisfying. I find they take quite a long time to write. But I think what's incredible about a novel is the deep commitment to it, sort of year after year, kind of keep re-engaging and trying to rediscover something, especially something that's challenging, I think is a really kind of an incredible experience. So I think both have their their joys. I think I learn a lot from writing stories about shape and structure that I can bring to writing novels in that way. Yeah.
That's interesting. I've heard other authors talk about short stories in that way, where they're a good way to learn exactly that, how to tell a story and shape a story. And in looking through your bio, I wasn't sure. Do you have an MFA or did you?
I don't have an MFA, no.
So how did you come to writing?
I came to writing in a circuitous way. I can't pronounce the word at this moment. In a circular fashion, I guess. I actually began as a dancer. I started when I was tiny, at 3, and then as an adult, a very young adult, moved to New York City to become a dancer. I ended up at the Merce Cunningham Studio and danced with a lot of choreographers that were very much kind of in his world and, you know, in his aesthetic. So I did that all my young adulthood. But at the while I was doing that, I was also writing stories, just little ones, and I loved doing it. It was something, reading was very important in our household when I was growing up. So stories were always something I loved to do, but the dancing was very much in the foreground of my life. But in my mid-30s, I wasn't a choreographer, so, you know, like any athlete, dancers sort of, their bodies begin to not do what they once did. So I was looking, you know, just sort of what would come next. And one thing that came next for me was going to college, because I hadn't quite done that yet. I'd been a dancer instead. So I was very fortunate. I got a ghostwriting job. I had sort of kept my writing up enough that I could do that, and it was a great job, and it sort of allowed me sort of the flexibility to go to school at night and, you know, sort of to you know, become an undergraduate. So, and it was the job was fabulous, because the person I was writing for, she really was very, very able to write her own books, but she just wanted somebody sort of generating scenes. So it was this kind of a great apprenticeship for me, because, you know, almost as long as I was writing, it was helpful to her, and she was going to sort of do other things with it anyway. So it was a wonderful job, and I had it for about 3.5 years. It sort of took me almost all the way through college. And when I was done, in the middle of it, I began publishing my own stories. So that's how I came to it.
I'm talking to Mary Beth Hughes. Her new novel is The Loved Ones. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. So from dancing to ghostwriting to novel and short story writing, does the dancing still, does it inform your writing in ways that you're aware of or that you can feel?
I am aware of it, actually, and it's something I've been thinking about lately. I feel that I'm very interested as a writer in sort of these sort of rhythmic patterns, and also sort of shape in the way I experienced it as a young woman, you know, sort of watching Merce Cunningham sort of choreograph. You know, he was a marvelous, as we all know, choreographer, and very inventive, and sort of, I think, because he did not impose a narrative, it was something he felt very strongly about, that dance should be freed from narrative. For me, as someone who loves stories, of course, I was always seeing stories in these, you know, in the movement of the dancers around me. And I think it was a great way of learning about sort of artistic shapes and artistic patterns. And I see that, I do see it happening very much in the way that I write. I'm always listening to sort of the sound of things, words, the way they sound and the way they land on the page. And I think that comes very much from watching him and then watching, you know, so many beautiful dancers at work, really.
That is interesting. And you mentioned also that reading was important in your home growing up. So then I'm curious who some of your favorite authors were then, and also what you're currently reading.
Oh, sure. It's funny. I was sort of looking at books I was reading when I was an older teenager, when I was really sort of starting to sort of choose my own books and in a bigger way. So I remember reading sort of. I'm surprised. I was reading sort of Gide, André Gide. I was reading, you know, Simone de Beauvoir, the Second Sex. And I have no idea why, you know, I would be reading French writers. Was very sort of peculiar. I remember reading Kierkegaard and finding, you know, sort of him sort of devastating and sort of right on the money for an older teenager, and that sort of, you know, life is very, very, you know, hard feeling. I think I was also remember reading Sinclair Lewis and sort of American writers. I always loved Willa Cather, and continue to adore her. I mean, I think she is really exceptional in so many ways. I just recently reread Death Comes for the Archbishop, which I just can't even tell you how exquisite I found that book, and so moving. I think she's really extraordinary. As I got older, I think the book that became sort of radically important to me, probably right before I wrote my first novel, was Penelope Fitzgerald's The Blue Flower. And I continue to find her, like Willa Cather, to be this great source of, you know, genius. I don't know what else to say. I mean, I read her pretty much all the time. You know, I'm always sort of picking her up and looking at different things that she's writing. Using the present tense, obviously, I find her sort of eternal. She's an ongoing presence for me. Right now, I'm reading Richard Price. I'm having a kind of a Richard Price book festival. I just read his new novel, The Whites, which he wrote under the pseudonym of Harry Brand, because it's meant to be, you know, kind of a police procedural, but it's, you know, I think it's very kind of literary in its approach, you know, surprisingly so. The characters are kind of fascinating, especially a woman character named Carmen is a great character in that book. And now I'm reading Clockers, which was an earlier novel of his that, for anyone who loves The Wire, this is kind of must reading, because I think it's kind of where The Wire sprung from. It's really an excellent book. And next for me is David Gates' new book, A Hand Reach Down to Guide Me. I can't wait. I'm a huge fan of his. So that's what I'm reading right now.
Wow, that's quite a variety, from André Gide to Willa Cather to Richard Price.
So, I know.
Mary Beth, we're drawing down on our time. But before we let you go, I want to ask you whether you have any writing advice for our writer listeners, perhaps on getting the most out of our descriptions and leveraging these sensory details in our writing.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about advice. I mean, I actually really love advice generally. I think it's fun to get advice and to think about advice. I read a beautiful interview by Mary Gaitskill. It's called The Wolf in the Long Grass, and it's collected in a book called The Very Telling, which was a compilation by Sarah Johnson. And Mary was asked to give advice to a young writer, and her advice was, don't ask for advice. I thought there was some truth to that, because I think each story, each novel seems to sort of call on something new and sort of to give sort of an overarching piece of advice might mean that, or to adhere to it, I guess, it might mean to miss something that was sort of very, very particular to that piece of writing. But that said, I do have a book to recommend, which is Louise DeSalvo's collection of tons of advice, which is called The Art of Slow Writing. It's really great. So anytime, you know, someone is stuck for advice, I would say, go there and see what she has to say. She's very good.
Well, Mary Beth, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Nicole. This has been great.
That was Mary Beth Hughes, author of the new novel, The Loved Ones, published by Grove Atlantic. During the second part of the show, debut author Lauren Acampora will be here, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with Mary Beth Hughes. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Lauren Acampora. Lauren's fiction has appeared in the Paris Review, Missouri Review, Prairie Schooner, New England Review, and Antioch Review. She is a graduate of Brown University and holds an MFA from Brooklyn College. She was raised in Connecticut and now lives in Westchester County, New York, with her husband, artist Tom Doyle, and their daughter. Her new book, a novel made up of interconnected short stories, is The Wonder Garden, just published in May by Grove Atlantic. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Lauren.
Hi, Nicole.
Let's start off.
Great to talk to you. Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you can join us. Can we start off by having you tell us a little bit about your book and introduce it for us?
Of course. Yeah, it is, you know, I'm happy to hear you call it a novel. I was hoping that some people might see it that way. That was my hope. It was written as a collection of short stories that some of which I had written a number of years prior and then ended up adding to and linking them sort of as I went. It's The Wonder Garden, and I guess I should start with how I came up with this idea. As you mentioned, I was born and raised in Connecticut. I grew up in a town called Darien, which is sort of a picture-perfect place. It's where it was actually the inspiration for The Stepford Wives, which is kind of came as no surprise to me. Very beautiful but homogeneous place. Not a lot of income disparity. Everybody was doing quite well. And a great place to be brought up as a child, but, of course, I couldn't wait to get out. And so I moved to New York City and lived there for many years until finally I met Thomas, my husband, in New York. And when it was time to start our own family, we decided to move back to the suburbs, this time Westchester County, New York, which isn't really very different from Connecticut. But this time around, it was so much more interesting to be in a place like this as an adult and as a fiction writer. I just find this area to be very rich ground for fiction writing. And just driving around and looking at all of the beautiful houses in this area, I just can't help but wonder about what goes on inside them and if, you know, the lives inside are as beautiful as the outside. Within a few weeks of moving to this town, I started thinking, oh, you know, maybe someday when I get to know the place a little better, when I get to know the psychology of the people in the suburbs a little better, it might be interesting to write some stories about, you know, neighbors, a group of neighbors, and how they all see themselves, how they see each other, and how those visions might be the same or might differ. So instead, you know, I had been working on a novel, as it happens, a true novel called The Umbrella Bird, and it was about a couple who moved to a suburb from New York City, and the husband becomes so enamored with the nature around their new house that he's out in the backwoods building a treehouse for their unborn daughter, and he believes that he has received a kind of mystical calling from the woods, and he's inspired to quit his executive advertising job and sort of become a new age healer, much to the chagrin of his expecting wife. And I loved these characters and I loved their story, and I finished the novel, but it wasn't good. It just wasn't a very good novel for a variety of reasons, but I was happy that I was able to salvage at least one story about them. And as it happens, I was reading a couple of really superior books at the time, and they both happened to be novels in stories. One was Olive Kitteridge by Elizabeth Strout, and the other was A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. And I fell in love with these books, and I thought they looked like so much fun to write that I found myself taking the story of the Umbrella Bird and linking it with some of the other characters that were sort of ancillary in the novel and giving those characters their own stories. And the next thing you know, I was writing that book that I had first thought of when I first moved here, except I got to it much sooner than I thought I would. I thought it would take me about a decade to get there, but no. It came out first, right after I moved here. So that is the long, long story of how the Wonder Garden came to be.
But I think
it's... I hope you're still there.
No, it's fascinating for writers and our listeners about these false starts that pay off in spades. So you wrote this novel, you know, The Umbrella Bird, which of course we recognize, as you said, as a title of one of the short stories in in the book. And so how quickly did you come to that realization? I imagine there's a stage of denial after you've completed a whole novel, or or what was that process like for you?
A very, very strong stage of denial. Yes, yes, yes. I gave that novel all of my energy, all my blood, sweat, and tears trying to finish that darn thing. I had a newborn baby, and I was just exhausted, and I must finish this novel, otherwise I'm not a writer anymore. But I did, and I just looked at it, and I gave it to my husband to read, and, you know, he was sort of mildly complimentary, he wasn't over the moon, and I knew there was something really wrong. I gave it to another friend who is a great editor, and she gave me just so many revision notes. And the problem was that, and I think that there's a point at which you don't want to revise it, and I think other writers probably would be familiar with this feeling. You just don't want to look at it anymore. It doesn't feel alive. The book just didn't feel alive to me. It felt like a slog. It felt like it was written by a tired person. And it was, and it just, it was missing a spark, and I can't, if I had to put my finger on it, it was the fault of the point of view, and it often is, I think, with books that don't work, and it's hard to see it when you're in it, but afterwards, after a little bit of distance, I could look and see, the book was written from the point of view of the wife, and she's such a passive character, just reacting to the, you know, to the eccentricities that her husband is displaying, and it just, it couldn't support a whole novel. It wasn't a strong enough scaffold to just respond and be, you know, to his actions. It worked a lot better as a short story. Yeah.
And as, I hope. Because it returns, her passivity is not a liability in the Wonder Garden, because you have fun with it and make it work for the greater narrative, it seems.
Yes, it worked a lot better as a short story, and then, you know, they return later on in the book, and you see how it actually is surprisingly, her passivity was surprisingly beneficial, but without all of the slow portions that the novel had in between. So instead of hearing about her, you know, hemming and hawing throughout all of this, we get to hear much more interesting stories from other characters in between. Yeah, I think it worked out okay. And when I was writing, when I changed the format to the collection of linked stories, it felt so much more alive. There was that spark that I was missing, and I was having a great time with it. It was really fun. I had to make myself stop coming up with more characters.
And that idea was yours to make that switch. It didn't come from a workshop or your MFA colleagues or anything.
Oh, no. This is the MFA is really long history. That was a long time ago. But it would have been nice to have MFA people looking at this. I mean, that's such a great, it's a great structure for writers to get that feedback. But no, this came really from reading those other books and being inspired by them.
So Lauren, would you read to us from The Wonder Garden?
Sure. Yeah. You know, it's the portion that I chose is from the story, The Umbrella Bird. I thought that would be fitting, just to give a sense. And it sort of gives a sense of the book as a whole. There's a lot of emphasis on houses and architecture and how our houses can act almost as an extension of ourselves, and how we want to be seen and how we want our personalities to sort of stand in, you know, in this architectural way. Let's see. So here we are. from The Umbrella Bird. Now, the characters, David and Madeline, have moved up from New York City, and they have purchased a beautiful new house, and they're just getting settled in. So here we go. The house has been sweepingly renovated, the front door framed by columns and topped by a counterfeit balcony. It's what the real estate agent had termed a center hall colonial, with a kind of timeless architecture and rigorous symmetry designed to leverage a calming effect on its inhabitants. Paired with precise, harmonious details, she implied, a house like this had the power to transform its owner's experience of the world, to render any obstacle, any boiler failure or termite siege, surmountable. Nearly all their money has gone to the down payment, and with the little that remains, Madeline is scrambling to furnish. With a Sharpie, she circles furniture in soft-lit catalogs, a sectional sofa, a leather armchair, a mirrored console table. Delivery men put them in place. Still, the rooms echo. Alone, she wanders the house on the balls of her feet. It is preternaturally quiet, the walls themselves thick with insulation, sealing out the buzz of the world. A sliding glass door displays a wide lawn tumbling to a thumb smudge of trees. She has reached it at last, this asylum, this glorious valve. Madeline had first glimpsed this kind of life as a girl, visiting a friend who'd moved to a verdant nook of New Jersey. Entering that house had been like entering a palace, the soaring entrance hall, floors that didn't sag toward the middle, bay windows looking out onto wanton grass and trees, the great yawn of sky. There, she'd learned to ride a bicycle. Pedaling back and forth on that wide blacktop driveway, she'd felt the first ecstasy of flight. She has never lived anywhere but in a gerbil cage. She has never had money. Her father was a bag-eyed jazz musician, dead in middle age. Her mother, a schoolteacher who supported them all. Madeline had diligently sidestepped adulthood in her parents' lopsided brownstone on Charles Street among the aging socialists and drag queens. Before meeting David, she had acquired the habits of every cynical city girl, shutting down dirty bars, flattering scrawny musicians, waking Sundays on ripped naugahyde couches. Tonight, he is out in the woods building a treehouse for their daughter who is due in a month. Although she will not use it for years, he has thrown himself into the project as if on a deadline. Each evening, when he comes home from work, he puts on old jeans, disappears into the garage, and cuts lumber with a power saw. Madeline has agreed not to visit the treehouse until it is finished. She watches David carry wooden planks over the grass to the woods, the late summer sun casting his long shadow before him. His hands have become splintered and raw, his forearms welted from the ash tree he has selected. This is his nature, she knows, this kind of focused work ethic. He lugs home stacks of library books about treehouse architecture. At night, he comes into the house with the look of an outdoorsman in soiled plaid shirts and patch-kneed jeans. Perhaps he has reverted to a forgotten self, his childhood on the farm, when he'd spent whole days in the woods hunting for turtle shells, mouse skulls, snake skins. He works on the treehouse later and later each night until he is coming indoors well after dark. Madeline does not want to complain. She wants him to feel free in his life with her. For years, he has lived as an independent man, but now, with parenthood advancing upon him, perhaps he feels invisible ropes tightening. She wants to show that she understands. He can build a treehouse if he wants to. Alone, she watches the evening news, its galloping soundtrack bridging one bleak segment to the next. Beyond the glass door, she sees David cross slowly over the grass, his figure becoming part of the deepening evening. At last, his silhouette melts into the dark line of trees. The glass door frames a phantasmagoric reflection of the room's interior, of Madeline's own bulging form. The news anchor begins a dirge about home foreclosures. There is talk of a stimulus package. People will be given old-fashioned things to do with their hands. Madeline herself is fabulously idle, having finally quit her series of temp jobs. This had been David's idea. He'd encouraged her to enjoy her pregnancy, to not feel ashamed for staying home with their child if that was what she wanted to do. She is not accustomed to so much aloneness. Nothing in her old life had ever approached this depth of quiet, this vacuum of night. She imagines animals in the woods surrounding the house, emerging when the sun sets to carry on their dark pursuits. She does not like to think of David out there, but restrains herself from going to retrieve him, from begging him to come inside and sit with her. She does not want to be that kind of woman. At last, after she has gone to bed, she hears the sliding door. Moments later, he is with her beneath the blanket, whispering apologies. There is a chill in his touch, a suggestion of autumn. He slides up against her spine, and a coil loosens inside her. What extraordinary luck, after all, this beautiful place, this wonderful man. At last, a real house with a mailbox and garden hose, a desirable suburb in a sterling school district, not too far from the city. A kind, intelligent husband with a lucrative career and domestic leanings. The child inside her settles itself, and she falls into dreamless sleep.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was author Laura Acampara reading from her new book, The Wonder Garden. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And I do think that was a brilliant selection to introduce the book, because you have this dichotomy of the real house with a mailbox and a garden hose, and we get a sense of both the house and the neighborhood, and also the unusual things that are starting to unwind. And so you have the suggestion that even though the picture is one way, what's going on inside the houses is another. And I was wondering if you could talk a little more about setting and capturing this community.
Ah, well, yeah, that's easy because I live here now. And, you know, there are, you know, everything that I've put in there, I've taken from the houses that I've seen in my own house and the woods that are behind the houses, which always have fascinated me, even when I was growing up as a child. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in the woods when I was a kid, and to me that was crucial to, you know, the sense of wonder, if you will, and magic that comes with childhood. And and then the houses, which, you know, all the varieties of architecture are always so interesting to me, and the choices that people make about what houses they want to inhabit and how they want them to look, and inside and out. And also my own feelings living here and having a house. This was my first time as a homeowner, and to be in the suburbs, there are a lot of expectations that come with owning a house in a nice sort of neighborhood, you know, the insecurities that come with it, you know, having to, you know, keep your lawn mowed and your house painted and looking sort of nice, and, you know, you don't want to bring down property values for everybody else. You don't want to be that neighbor. There are some like that, I'm very fascinated by the that sort of communal expectation that comes with a town and a neighborhood, and the people who, and I hope this is all making sense, but the people who put so much energy into the appearances of their setting, and the people who have other things that they're thinking about and maybe let the house go a little bit, and how do they see each other, and what judgments sort of come to pass, and what is the story behind each of those people? You know, that's what's really interesting to me. The setting, to me, I suppose the answer is that the setting is an entree into character in this particular instance with this book. When I see the beautifully kept house, I want to know the story of the person inside. And when I see the house with the peeling paint, I want to know the story of that person and how they see themselves and how they look at their neighbors and think, and what judgments come, whether they get each other right or if they're way off, if that makes sense.
Sure. No, it does make you think, because that's where a lot of the meat is, in this projected perfection and then all these different experiences of like what it even means to bring down property values. Because there's that great story about the, you know, neighborhood dispute about one house in particular. And
right. 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 Yeah. That story was somewhat inspired by a true story, which I don't know, the listeners in California may or may not be familiar with this. It did make national news. It was in the New York Times. But, you know, sort of a local story, which is there's a family in Connecticut that, you know, they're major art collectors. They had installed a piece of contemporary art on their front lawn in a very exclusive town, and an avant-garde piece of art with some, it's sort of cement and some rebar sticking out, and you know, a very valuable piece of art, but not necessarily to everyone's taste. And they were sued by the town. The town said they did not have a permit, that the piece of art was not art, but a structure that they had erected on their property without a permit. And the town won, and they were forced to take the piece of art out, and they ended up donating it to a museum, so it sort of has a happy ending. But I was always just fascinated by that story, and I always root for the people who are a little bit of a nonconformist, and I wanted them to be able to keep that piece. But that conflict to me just speaks volumes about how people view themselves, how they view their neighborhood, and that's where the story Swarm came from.
I'm talking to Lauren Acampora. Her debut novel, told in interconnected stories, is The Wonder Garden. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Lauren, we're going a little short on our time, but I did want to talk to you about these labels, because you mentioned before about, you know, calling it a novel. Or for me, I think novels are, the structure is being pushed. You mentioned Olive Kitteridge and Welcome to the Goon Squad.
A Visit from the Goon Squad.
And even recently, yeah, we spoke with Matt Summel about his book, Making Nice, and this question of labels came up. I mean, how can you talk a bit how that has come up for you as an issue, if it has, or how you think of it, or just...
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, I wrote it as stories, a collection of stories that were linked. I remember asking the publisher, I said, do you think we can market it as a novel? Because that's what people want. They want novels. And they said, well, you know, we don't want to... If we write a novel on the cover, then people will expect a certain thing, and they may be disappointed if they don't get a traditional novel. And so, but they didn't want to write stories on the front, so it has nothing on the front. It just says The Wonder Garden, and if you want to find out what it is, you have to read the flap copy. And I have had somewhat of a drawback to that, I think, which is in reading some of the reader reviews that have popped up online, which I have since stopped doing, but some of the reader reviews express a very strong degree of disappointment that this novel did not come together. And the chapters just sort of end. And, you know, I just want to say, no, but they're stories. They're stories. They're not chapters. That's why they have titles. And, oh, my goodness. So not every reader reads the flap copy, is what I have learned. And, you know, it's sort of it's a crapshoot whether people will get it or won't. So it's a double-edged sword, I suppose. But it is what it is. I don't know. You know, it's not a novel. It's not really a short story collection. It's something in between. And, you know, I think that not every publisher is keen to take that sort of a hybrid on. They want something that's easily labeled. And I'm hoping that as more of these books do well, you know, Olive Kitteridge, Visit from the Goon Squad, you know, with any luck, my book, you know, maybe these labels will become a little blurrier and it won't matter so much.
Yeah, Rebecca Mackay has a hilarious Plowshares blog post recently about...
Oh, my gosh.
Have you seen that one? About?
I have. Yeah. I was snorting through my nose reading that. It was so funny. This book took too long to download on my Kindle. 1 star. Or this book, the cover tour after 1 week, 1 star. And, yeah, the chapters just sort of end. That would be mine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what made me think of it.
Yeah, she's great.
Well, Lauren, before we let you go, I just want to ask one last question, which is there any favorite writing advice that we haven't covered that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Writing advice?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know where to start.
Maybe about, you know, letting go of something or letting a project
about,
morph.
About what? Sorry?
Oh, about letting a project go or letting it go where it needs to go.
Yeah. I think the only kind of writing advice I can think of for that would be to just sort of shut out your internal critic while you're doing a first draft and just write as much. You know, I tend to take copious sort of notes, not notes, but just, you know, write down everything I want to have happen and then polish it as I go rather than going one sentence at a time. I mean, every writer works differently in how they're comfortable, but I think a universal piece of advice would be turn off that critic while you're doing your first draft. Otherwise, you might just seize up and not be able to continue and get too concerned about whether it's working or not. You know, I have a great little book of, it's a kind of maybe slightly corny, but a little book of writing advice called Walking on Alligators. It's a little paperback book with quotes and little meditations for writers that I have found totally indispensable. And a lot of the quotes remind you to not worry too much when you're first getting it down. Just get it down and just write the next sentence or whatever it is to keep you going. And do not try to edit. Don't try to judge your own writing until you have finished the first draft at the very least. And I would say try to keep as open as you can to what you want to say for as long as you can, and just defer that editing until you're really, really ready. I usually write in single. I write single spaced on the computer, and will not double space it until I feel like it's really a solid draft. And once I've double spaced it, then I can edit.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Lauren Acampara, author of the new book, The Wonder Garden, published by Grove Atlantic. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, either Barbara or Marie will be back. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue, coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.